So Ryan, when we were talking about this scenario, you even said that, oh, it was tough trying to decide which one you would really do. And so I'm going to ask you here, do you think you really would have the fortitude to shut everything down and fly for almost an hour and a half with everything turned off when you got an airport right below you, you were just at, granted right at minimums? Would you do it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I'm not sure that I would, and that puts a point on the value of figuring these things out in advance and going through these scenarios in your head. There's a few options here which could be reasonable choices, and it feels like you've got a lot of time to think about it. You've got a couple hours of fuel left, but the reality is that if you need the VFR option, best case, you only have 45 minutes of fuel left by the time you get there. So you kind of have to make a decision now.
And it's almost like you're saying you kind of have to make a decision even before now.
Right.
Like you've got to have a running plan that's going on about, boy, where am I going to go if I lose electrical power? Because that's a real critical thing here.
Right. And this type of scenario isn't uncommon on training flights. You have a local training flight where it's a widespread IFR day, and you think, well, I'm just going to take a couple hours of fuel because I'm going to do a couple local approaches and then be done. But if your electrical system goes down, anything, marginal VFR conditions are useless for you. You got to find a way to VFR, and you better have enough fuel for that.
So we're all on the same page here, right? Everybody is heading for Georgia. I'm sure of it, right? Bob.
I'm landing, and I'm going to do the RNAV 1-8 approach and make it happen this time. This is an emergency.
What does that mean, Bob? Make it happen.
Sounds like a duck under to me.
What does it mean?
No, it means I'm going to stay on that approach right down to minimums. And we have just completed an approach on that runway. And I make one statement to ATC, and that's that if I don't complete the approach, I'm going to head for VFR conditions. But I've got a reasonable expectation that I can make this approach.
What are you going to do if you get to minimums and you don't see it?
Going to go to VFR conditions.
So you're going to do it then. It's going to cost you 20 minutes for that, plus climbing and turning up around. You're now going to reach VFR conditions with, plain devil's advocate here, 25 minutes of fuel.
Well, I don't know if it's going to take us 20 minutes of fuel. We're going to climb to altitude, get vectored to the approach, and remember, the remainder of the approach, we're going to be pulling back to power. So let's say we're going to use 10 minutes of fuel.
Well, I'm going to just modify your choice a little bit, Bob. For me, I'm probably going to make that approach, but I'm going to use my emergency authority, and I'm going to land. Okay. I'd like to break out at minimums, but if I don't, I'm going to keep coming. I got a real asset in a almost instrument instructor to help me. I think I would enlist the help of that person and say, help me with my scan, talk to me, work out some division of activities and use all the assets I could, but I would land.
So this is an airport that doesn't have any maintenance services. It's still, 30, 35 minutes from home. I guess I don't see the urgency to get on the ground now in this situation. And I think if I wanted to use the IFR option, the one I was leaning towards was going to Tallahassee, because that gives you an ILS down to 200 feet, Category 2 runway. Pretty confident of getting in there. And the reason I rejected that one is because we're just about as far away from home as we are with the VFR option. So it doesn't really provide an advantage there. And if we don't get in there for some reason, if we misjudge the battery life, now we've got problems, because we better dead reckon perfectly.
Kind of similar to what Ryan, there's a tough choice here. And as I said, you don't really have a whole lot of time to think about this. But you back up a little bit, and I'm in the clear between layers here, and I'm reasonably expecting it to be clear between layers all the way to Georgia, 150 miles away or something like that. That's a known option. To do the approach again with a questionable battery, what happens if you're you're at 800 feet going down that glide slope and you lose everything? Now you're climbing, you've got the distraction of that, and you're going to be climbing out doing your missed approach with whatever you got left, if it's just that standby attitude indicator and stuff. So I guess it's, would you knowingly enter IMC conditions again with the airplane in this situation, or would you stay in VMC and just scoot for a known out? And I think the initial thing would be, yeah, let's get on the ground. But thinking about it more, I would think to go towards the VMC and stay in VMC.
So John, you're saying you would fly to Georgia?
Correct.
You'd shut everything down and fly to Georgia?
Yeah, because I wouldn't want to take the chance of losing everything on that approach into Tallahassee or back into Foley. Because we don't really know how long this is all going to last.
It's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard spot.
It
really is. Both options have, certainly the option of going to Georgia will have, from my mind, a satisfactory resolution. Any other option does not necessarily have that. And we get into the risk-reward. What might work for Bob to shoot the approach and say, I'm going to use my emergency authority and duck under if I have to, that's worth it for him. And maybe for Wally, say, no way in hell, I'm going to Georgia. It's risk-reward, and this is a personal thing, you know. And so it's difficult for us, each of us, in that situation. The other thing is also knowing how to use all this different equipment. As an example, talked about, well, dimming the Aspen down. You'd be surprised how many people I fly who own Aspens who don't know how to dim down the screen. And I'll ask, because I have to do a partial panel approach, this is on a practical test. I say, what do you do to go partial panel? Oh, I use stickies. And I say, no, have you ever read the manual? But so you really need to know your equipment. You need to know how long it lasts. And I've got to say, you offered me the choice of this scenario, and I fly an Aspen, and I was reluctant to do it because I realized I'd have to really get back into the manual and do some studying.
Like, we put Ryan on that.
And his response was wonderful, and I learned from it, actually. And it made me go back to the manual and read, what is my Aspen really do? But how many pilots who fly with this equipment really do know it? And that really, this knowledge of your systems really affects that decision and the risk-reward equation.
I've been right on the fence about this the whole time he's been reading through it. It's down to 1 and 4. And I think, John, I think you pushed me over the edge on it, combined with what Doug has said, which is that, yes, number one will get us on the ground sooner if it works out. But there is a case where a duck under is one thing, but if you can't track the final approach course because the battery died while you were being vectored to final, you're in some sort of trouble. You've burned up some of your reserve, and it's not a huge reserve to begin with. The lack of services at the airport is also a concern. So I always brief before I land at an airport what services are there. So the lack of services that are there, we're going to land, if we do make it, with depleted battery. What are we going to do once the weather clears up? How are we going to get home? What is it really buying us on the ground? The only argument I could see for number one is if you have a concern that what else is going to go wrong. If something has happened to the alternator, are we confident that this isn't a failure which is going to spread to other systems? So far in my limited experience, when the alternator dies, it tends to be a relatively self-contained thing. Except in the one case where my alternator bracket broke and the alternator was physically bouncing around inside the cowl, doing who knows what to other parts of the plane. Could have snapped a belt, could have caused some problems. So that may be an argument towards number one, but that notwithstanding, I'd prefer number four because I don't see ways of number four failing. It's a little uncomfortable to go so long with the electronics off, but it seems safer except for the alternator bouncing around case.
To me, this seems like an argument between land as soon as possible and land as soon as practical. I think this is an emergency, so I put this in the land as soon as possible category versus an abnormal situation where you might say, okay, we'll land as soon as practical here. But I still am stuck on doing that approach.
I'm really personally lean towards going to Georgia. But one thing that we haven't discussed, we've talked about conserving electricity, but we haven't talked about in this situation, we really need to conserve fuel to give us another out. And just that, you know, let's go to an economy cruise as we head to Georgia.
That's an excellent point. But, you know, now to the point you made, Keith, about how could going to Georgia go wrong, that's an hour and a half away. And if we go to economy cruise, it might be an hour 45 minutes or even an hour 50 away. That's almost 2 hours of weather change. And we are counting on the fact that we're going to have VFR there. The longer it takes us to get there, the less confident we are. And we don't have a good way, when which we shut everything down, of updating that information and making a change of plan. So, you know, it gets into cascade failure too. You're used to flying around with ADS-B weather, and I can check the weather and watch it going down. We just turned off our ADS-B transponder. So, you know.
Well, our best weather information is the weather that we just experienced a couple minutes ago.
If we take the diversion now to VFR conditions, we've also preserved electrical power for in case the weather does change, and we can possibly make something work if it's not good VFR.
So one thing that probably would happen here, because you did communicate to Jacksonville Center what your situation was and what your plan was, and if you're going to fly, because you're still IFR, and you know they might tell you an altitude to fly or something like that, and they're going to be following you the whole way. They can follow primary target the whole way. You're probably going to see some F-16s at some point too. I mean, it's very, very possible. 2 hours IFR in a system, NORDO, you're probably going to get intercepted. And something to consider also. How that would affect it, you know, who knows? Maybe the intercept would provide you some guidance to another airport or something.
Yeah. You know, give you a plane to follow, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Who knows? F-16s don't do real well with Cherokee 140s in terms of speed, but... But the other thing that I just wanted to touch on too, and I think you did a little bit in your response, was let's talk about doing practice approaches in 400-foot ceilings in a 100-knot airplane that has three. We took off with 3 hours of fuel, and we know the nearest good weather is 150 miles. You know, was that really a good plan to start off that way? And how many times do we do that kind of stuff too? You know, thinking that we're just going to go out and do a couple approaches and come back. So. And given 100-knot training airplanes, it can be real hard sometimes to find a legal alternate and do the flight planning and all that. I mean, does anybody want to talk about that, too? It's, you know.
Well, I think anytime you launch in this type of an airplane, IFR, with a lot of widespread low IFR around, you need to consider as part of your pre-flight planning, what are my alternatives if that alternator fails? Because we all know they fail.
If it goes below minimums at all these airports too, we're not far above, you know.
All of us here have had alternator failures at one time or another in our career. And the other thing you need to think about is what am I going to do if the vacuum pump fails? If that's in this airplane, we have an Aspen, so that's good, but often we have vacuum powered instruments. So I think that's just needs to be part of your normal pre-flight planning, whether you're doing a training flight or a regular flight cross country.
Kind of back to Jeff's original question, would you make this decision or would you be pulled in another direction? I think the one answer that we haven't talked about that might be superficially attractive would be the go home to Gainesville option, because now you're home. They've got approaches down to 200 feet. It's something like 40 minutes away. So we'd be probably pushing it with the electrical power. But I think there might be a temptation to, when this happens, say, okay, we're going to head home now. Yeah. And then you get yourself into trouble, because if you try the approach there and don't make it, you know, we've got a long way to go now with just barely enough fuel to get there.
Well, that brings up the, you know, try the approach and don't make it. You know, in the two folks we have here at the table that were going to just try the approach right at Perry Foley, you know, one of you, there is no don't make it, right? Like you're going down no matter what under emergency authority. And with an LPV guidance, you know, we all know from experience, that's fairly accurate guidance. Now, that's assuming you're in the right place as you're flying the approach. But let's talk about a little bit about that, you know, I'm going down all the way no matter what. I'm, you know, personally, I kind of like Tallahassee for that reason. Like, that's a big target that's going to be really well lit. And you know what? Get to that and fly that approach down no matter what. And then a Cat 2 ILS. So even if I can have the GPS, I've got a verified ILS down to 100. You know, so let's talk a little bit about the, you know, when would you be like, forget about the minimums. This is just happening.
Well, a couple of things that give me confidence to try the approach is the fact that we just did it. Mm-hmm. And we did break out at minimums. And sure, it's going to take 10 or 15 minutes to get back around there and do it again. Maybe the weather will go down. If it does, it's not going to go down to zero. And so I can use my emergency authority and sneak down below those minimums with this good guidance. I agree. I'd rather have a Category 2 runway out there to shoot at. But the fact that we've just done that and the fact that we have 12.5 volts on the voltmeter tells me that pretty good chance my electrical system is going to hold up for another 15 minutes. If it doesn't work, if I really get out of position, muck up the approach so bad that I have to go around, then I've got a dead reckoning myself up to VFR and try your solution.
This seems like a great time to tell ATC that you'd like a vector inside the gate. So ATC can shorten up these approaches for you, but they will not do it unless you request it. And in fact, under emergency authority, if you're really trying to save that battery power, you might say, hey, can we get direct to the final approach fix? Assuming you can get your approach to arm, so this is one of the nuances of GPS approaches, they normally want to join 2 miles outside the final. But if you can find a way to hammer that thing into giving you correct guidance, I'd shorten it up as much as you feel comfortable shortening it up.
Well, that's a great point about as much as you feel comfortable, because you know, now how much do you shorten it up and then end up behind on the approach and blow the approach? Is it better to actually, you know,
get it right,
invest another 2 or 3 minutes? Like, vector me way out. I want to make sure I am, you know, absolutely lined up on this approach.
Like, you have to get outside the final approach fix for it to sequence. So if you cut it too tight, you're going to create a lot of work for yourself at a real bad time.
Right. I don't know about the vectoring way out. Way out is not a phrase use, because every time any mile you add going out is a mile coming back in, and that battery is ticking down. So that's the balancing act.
If it were an ILS approach, maybe you could really shortcut it, but not on this.
Mm-hmm. But that gets down to knowing your equipment and knowing, you know, what it can do, how to force it into a particular mode. Even if you come in close and you do get it sequenced correctly, what you're going to get is a sudden change of CDI width. So you'll be, you know, seeming you're almost centered, and then all of a sudden, whoop, you know, your 3/4 scale deflection. If you know that's coming, it's not as big a deal as if it's a sudden surprise and there's a panic response when you don't have a lot of time. That could be a real issue.
If I were going to do that, I would belt and suspender that approach, because you got two, in this airplane, you've got two GPSs, and the second one is driving a conventional CDI. So you got the ILS in one, you got the GPS in the other, you know, and if doesn't sequence or whatever, you could make it work from that point without having to go around and go back. But you'd really have to belt and suspender as a whole approach.
Also a good time to fly the approach quickly. This is why I force myself to fly approaches at a wide range of speeds. This is a fantastic time to abandon, you know, being established at 80 knots from God knows how far away. Since fuel is not the concern here, it's battery, I'd rather fly the approach as fast as I comfortably could, knowing that we've got to get the thing configured. But this is a time to try and keep your speed up as long as you can.
And you could easily slow the Cherokee down and land on it. It's like an 8,000-foot runway or something. But what would happen if you committed to that, and I think that's what we go back to, and now you're at 300 feet and everything dies, you know? So now we're going around, and now we're going to Georgia with a half hour less gas, which is why I opted not to do that.
Yeah, I think how long the battery lasts is a tough question for me. I have some idea of how long it's supposed to last and when things might start dropping offline, but it's mostly a theoretical thing. I don't have the experience with it to know. So I'm going to err on the side of the battery's not going to last very long. Leave myself an out for if that happens.
And that's actually an interesting point that Wally brought up about, okay, we've got 12.5 volts and you haven't started load shedding yet. So this is a battery under load and it's down to 12.5, right? Because you haven't turned things off. That's actually a technique. It's another technique we don't practice really, like judging how long a battery goes down. So maybe you can go up in VFR conditions, pull the breaker for the alternator, see what your battery says, start pulling some breakers, you're in VFR conditions, shut things down, and see how fast it goes down. Because this airplane has a load meter to begin with, which is going to read zero. But if you have a voltmeter, you should be able to watch that battery voltage depleting and have a good sense of when things start to go offline. And have a good sense it's not dropping down that quickly. You know what? I got 35, 40 minutes with just one radio on and my transponder on, and this is working. It's just another thing. You know, we look at for missions to go up in VFR conditions.
But just what if when you did that test, your battery was, you just installed this new battery and you want to check it out. Mm-hmm. And now it's 2 years later. And boy, when I've had an alternator failures, one time I said, I couldn't believe it was daytime VFR, and I was actually on a departure from my home base airport, but I couldn't believe how fast that battery was losing voltage. It was an old you know.
But at least you looked at the voltmeter. You knew it was dropping voltage fast, and you could make decisions based on that. So if it's holding voltage, that number is the Bible right there. If it isn't dropping, you're actually doing okay. So that can give you some confidence. But if it's dropping fast, then it's brown trousers time.
And that's and that's something to work into your emergency planning. And there's an opportunity to go out and do something different, see what your charging system does and what shuts things down. If this Piper had the old lights on it with a mechanical turning beacon in the back, man, those lights are going to draw an amazing amount. If it's been upgraded with LED lights, they hardly draw anything. Mm-hmm. So there's knowing your systems and knowing how these things works is critical.
Yeah, and I think without the digital load meter too, it's a different situation because now we don't know, did we catch the problem right away or not? I mean, we could have been having a discharge on the ammeter for the last 15 minutes and it's about to die, and that changes how much electrical reserve we might think we have.
I was just going to mention, and I got a cigarette lighter charger, okay? I won't say where I got it from, but the last time and it was great because the last time I had an alternator failure, I heard this thing, and it was on takeoff into IMC conditions. I heard this thing actually beeping. I'm on takeoff. I'm not going to scan my alternator on takeoff. I scan other things, but my alternator's not one of them. I've already checked the alternator in my run-up. And it started beeping. I said, what the hell is that beeping? It's the charger, and it's telling me it's lost amperage. And that made me abort the takeoff. And so
handy.
It was way handy.
That's fantastic.
And so the other thing, to go back on it, knowing your airplane and knowing that kind of stuff, and this particular airplane, as many older airplanes, it doesn't even have a POH. It just has a handbook, which is basically useless in terms of troubleshooting. And knowing the airplane going forward, from this airplane has been heavily modified, and the interaction of all that stuff, do we really know what circuit breakers control everything anymore? And not so much in an alternator failure situation, but in almost any situation, you know, it has the original Piper panel with all those circuit breakers, but what do they control anymore? Do you really know all that stuff? And what relays control and, you know, all that stuff? It could be a rat's nest back there under the panel.
Yeah, and it can be a rat's nest too, just of the interactions between devices and what goes offline when you lose GPS source and your iPad being, you know, connected to your transponder. You're thinking you've got this great backup AHARS, and no, now I got to turn off the backup AHARS and so forth. And you brought up, Ryan, a whole bunch of the subtle differences between, well, if you have an Aspen, it's this, and if you have an Garmin G5, it's this. So it really comes down to thinking through. It really comes down to thinking through on the ground what the different possibilities could be when you've got time on a rainy day or, you know, an icing day, and then going out to your airplane or going up on a VFR day and trying these different things and keeping up on what the different procedures would be. So you've got a plan for the days when you're out there in the elements, but if one thing were to go wrong, then suddenly your well-intentioned plans sort of all fall apart, and you want to have a contingency in place before that happens.